I was just coming 21. And just think what that would do to someone who's trying to conjure up for himself a creator of indestructible matter. You can just see what that would do. And then when I got in there, but I did notice one thing. There was only one admonition laid down in that first chapter. Only one admonition laid down. Be ye fruitful and multiply. No rules. No ruling. Just the word God, simple God. Just that, a creator, simple God. Nothing more than that. And, all in all, a rather kindly story. Here's a sort of indulgent father who builds a wonderful thing for his children. But it's rather in that sense, in that you don't have to believe it, but it's a story. It's a rather kindly thing. And then bingo, I come to chapter 2. This kindly creator who built this wonderful planet suddenly becomes what? God? No. Lord God. King God. And immediately, when he gets up to that point, Adam is all kinds of jobs laid on to him, and all kinds of conditions laid down upon him, and the most unreasonable of all is that he's placed in this garden here, and it says this, and of every tree which groweth in this garden thou shalt eat, but of this tree thou shalt not eat. And even that wasn't true. And then, on the day thou shalt surely die. But, as the story goes, Eve didn't quite fall for it. She says, the devil may be doing it. She went up and I said, I'm going to take one nibble of that thing. I'm going to take one nibble of that thing. And I said, you know what happens? And she did, and that tastes pretty good. So she inveigled Adam to doing the same thing. Pretty smart gal, even stopped to think of it. And then they said, oh, what the heck are you doing running around here naked? And here comes the old boy. He didn't know it until he came down and saw him naked on with fingers on. And what did he do? Began laying down more harsh rules, just as all ruling classes have. And we have, instead of a simple story of a creation, we have a new master class philosophy. We have people of certain, of greater and lesser degree. Lays the whole world. We have good people, we have bad people. And all of the things that set us at one another's throat are brought in. Then I think of the heroes. First I come to that wonderful character, Methuselah, 960 years. Well, I got Tracy back one time, just out of curiosity, back. Now, he was born at this time, and he died 960, I'm not sure the exact number, over 900 years, he died. But, this I begin reading about Noah, that was the year of the flood, he must have drowned. I don't know where to get rid of the guy who was drowning. Then I hear about Noah. Oh, that noble character, Noah. He was so perfect in his generations that he was the one who was chosen to reproduce the world, the people of the world, after they'd been destroyed. Oh, he's a noble character. He gets so doggone drunk that he makes an indecent exposure of himself. One of his sons laugh at the spectacle, and he says, "You're to be a servant of all the rest of people. From now on, not only you, but all of the generations following." That was Ham. And that is the thing that we base, that is the base thing upon which all racism is. Oh, that noble character. And then there was one of his daughters, one of his daughters who married Lot. And you know the story of Lot, how she changed the pillar of salt. But do you remember the aftermath after she turned the pillar of salt? Do you remember the aftermath of that? The two daughters got the old, he said they did anyhow, got him drunk, and each one of them had a kid to him. Oh, those are noble people.
So a short career
what?
Did you have a short career then as a born-again Christian?
Yeah, well, yes, then I came, I very quickly left the church, and that is how I come into the social part.
How was that?
Here I was. Where did I belong? What was I? What am I? How do I identify myself? To me, there is nothing above, nothing below. Here I am, just an inhabitant. But since that's so, since I know what that story for what it is, how in the world did the human race get here? And I, at that moment in my history, I thought that each species had been created separately and intact in some way that had come into existence, separately and intact as a. And then. It was I went up, in that same year, I went up into Canada. And I didn't learn during that first summer that you better save enough for that cold winter that's coming ahead, or you're going to be cold and hungry all winter. And I found myself in Calgary, broke, able to subsist on just whatever small, short jobs I could find. I remember for one whole week I lived on what they called a pork pie, and was a considerable. A little made in a small shape of a small pie with a chunk of pork in the center about that big. I know I subsisted on two of those a day for one whole week. But had no money. The shows were everything was shows and taverns and everything were closed on Sundays in those days. Theaters and all. So the Socialist Party of Canada, of Calgary, that rented one of those theaters every Sunday night and held their meetings on Sunday night. And since it was a nice warm place to go, I thought, well, I'd be out of the cold that long anyhow. So rather than sitting in that crematorium where I was born. By the way, crum was a vernacular for lice. And and I think the second night I slept there rather bored. The first night I slept there rather bored. But on the second night, a series of six lectures began based on a book called From Nebula to Man. And suddenly, this unfolded. Now I was on my way. The cobwebs, that cleared away the cobwebs. That put me into, I wouldn't have expressed it this way at that time, into a logical, thing. Reasoning from cause to effect. And to learn more, I joined the Socialist Party. And then I begin to understand that not only had our whole universe, our solar system, our planet, and all of the living and unliving things were evolved, I found there that society was an evolutionary process. At times it seemed to move forward swiftly, and by the way of revolution. But there was, if you kept track of the rhythm, just as you take track of the inequalities in the height of tide, you will find that there is a certain, not time rhythm, but a certain evolutionary rhythm that perhaps that increases in accelerating. It as time goes on, it's accelerated from primitive herd form of family. And it was the only social structure they had, to the formation of tribes. The union of several families was a long process that went on perhaps eons, is what we say now. See? But the next step from tribe to clan to nation didn't take one tenth time to evolve from the herding type of family to the tribe. From the building of cities to the forming of nations with all of the political structures. And from city to kingdom, from kingdom to empire. That's really, and all of that has occurred within the last 12,000 years. And when we think, when we don't know how many hundreds of millions of years man existed before the first city was built, before the first tribe was formed, you can see how this is going accelerating logarithmically rather than in arithmetic or even geometrically.
What sort of things did you want to join the Socialist Party?
Well, the first one, I didn't get into much there. I was, let's say, a student during all that time. And boy, what a student, and what professors I had, the toughest ones you can ever think of. They used to meet around and have me sit at the table. Whenever they got a student, he was more of a victim than a student. Because they would get around the table, and they would fire questions at me that opponents to socialism might fire at me. And I was expected to be able to answer, no matter what field of science they might attack me on. I was supposed to, and then if I didn't know, I was very well told, very emphatically told, well, you better go read up on this. So, and that, well, but that was fine. Philosophically, that was fine. But the Socialist Party Hall and the IWW Hall were separated by half partition.
At were they friendly at that point?
No.
Were those two parties?
Yes, they were. But the IWW had, by that time, had, remember, I'm talking 1910, and they discarded political action in 1908. So it wasn't too long, actually. And meantime, I was beginning to learn a little, but not gradually, because my adherence was to the Socialist Party. But at the same time, the IWW was also wanting me to become a member. Well, they had no numerical significance at that time. So they hadn't, especially in that part of Canada, in Alberta and in through there, through the harvest country of Canada, they had no numerical significance, so I never come into any experience with them. But then in
1914,
about August of 1913, I came back to the United States. By the way, it came down from Regina down through South Portal, Canada, which is north of North Portal, North Dakota, and down through to Minot, and I worked some in the harvest fields around Minot, and I only happened to catch enough game, but there was a county fair going on at Hardy, and the next county seat down, away from there. I was working there at a county fair. I got a short job at the county fair there, helping the fellow get an aeroplane into the air. We had to, I don't mean in any mechanical sense. We had this thing was had to have a steep ramp, and he would start his motor and getting it going as fast as he could, and still keep it. Then we would get behind us and run down that ramp, pushing all as hard as we could, so that he'd have enough climb to get over the fence. And he had a tremendous ceiling of perhaps 500 feet. That's as high as it would go. It was at Harvey, North Dakota. And while I was there, I heard about the free speech fight, which started in Minot. Now, this developed around the fact that they were building, you see, as I told you, that I had got some early harvest. I think it must have been oats or something that time that dried them quickly. But there was a building, they were building a normal school, teacher's college we call it now, at Minot. And the contractor, taking advantage of the fact that they were hundreds and hundreds of harvest hands waiting for the harvest available, they had cut the wages down. I don't know what the actual wage paid, but perhaps something like $1.50, $1.25, $1.50 a day, something like that. Just not even a subsistence wage. But the IWW came in there, and some of them got jobs on there, and they quickly got the jobs organized, and they called a strike, which didn't suit the city fathers one bit. They began trying to round up the IWW and drive them out of town to break the strike. But in that days we had a song went, as fast as they can pinch us, we can always get some more. And as they take them and put them in jail, more and more of us came in. And I, being a young revolutionary, I heard of the free speech fight and thought it was that I must go up and take part in it, which I did. I didn't last long. One night, one evening. Boy, as a free speech fighter, jailed, of course. They were paving the main street of Minot at that time with wooden blocks. And these blocks were piled up on each side of the street in piles, not stacks, more or less loose piles. And that was to be our soapbox. That was to be the soapbox. Well, on the night that I said, what time will we start? And they said, 5 o'clock. And so at 5 o'clock, I'd already been instructed in the legal side of it. And at 5 o'clock, I was down there and seeing nobody on there. I said, well, I guess I better start it. I never made a public speech in my life. In fact, I never made a public speech until I was in my 80s. And I got up on the box, and I remember saying, friends, comrades, and fellow workers. And two policemen come up to grab me, pulled me down off the block. I said, am I under arrest? He said, no. I said, you better take your hands off of me. Now, if I'm under arrest, you take me to jail. If I'm not under arrest, keep your hands off of me. So they let go. And I walked down a few steps. And when I seen an opportunity to get on a second pile of these wooden blocks, I got up there, friends, comrades, fellow workers, and the same thing come back again. And again I warned you, but this time it was an actual warning. I said, now either you arrest me or you keep your hands off of me, and this is the last time I'm going to warn you. Because either I'm under arrest or you're guilty of assault. Oh, yeah. So I went down, and this time I was right in front of the post office. Well, you know, With all of us, there are certain symbols that mean home. And I remember the beauty I how much more beautiful I thought the Stars and Stripes than the Canadian flag with the maple leaf emblem and, you know, down in one corner and so forth and down there. And I thought how much prettier our flag was. And he right floating right out over me with a north wind blowing there, blowing there over there, and that's why I beautifully stretched out there, and I got up on the box again in defense of my constitutional rights, and I said, friends, comrades, and fellow workers, and that's as far as you get. And the same two grabbed me. I kicked the feet out from under one, just reached out, kicked the feet out to the other, and grabbed the other one. As he staggered against him, I grabbed the other one and tripped him the other way. And last time in a says scat, there was five or six men around working me over. But they were so unsure footing of where these loose blocks were, one thing or another, maybe they weren't very efficient at their job. And I don't know what they were doing more damage to each other than they were to me. But anyway, they laid my scalp open here. And it was hot. It was a hot, just pre-harvest time. Hot, and I'd already been through exertion. I guess my adrenaline content was pretty high, and the blood streamed down over my, my cap. Now the blood streamed down over my face and neck and down my sleeve, and when I looked at it, I saw what a gory thing it was, and I began to get a good picture. I began wiping this all over me. Two ladies run out from the curb. In the meantime, two of them had me, and three more behind. One had my east arm, and they were escorting me, not to the jail, but in the opposite direction. Two women came out. What are you doing to this poor man? Where are you taking him? Oh, we're taking him to jail. Well, you're going the wrong direction. You brutes, and oh, it was in there. I believe, honestly believe, that was that spectacle that I put on there at that moment. Now, townspeople, previous to that time, I mean the rank and file townspeople, were either on neutral or hostile. But immediately after that incident, when these women came out, their bricks, they've been, the people were standing to see the show, they were up on top of some bricks, began to be heaved into the street from these buildings that were thrown because there was no item beyond, they could only have been thrown at the special police that they had there. I believe that was a turning point, because a day or two later, they took me to the jail, and I won't bother with the details of how we bedeviled them even after we was in jail, how we tore the guts out of the jail when they turned the, I say we, I wasn't in on that, how they turned the steam heat on them to quiet them, and they quickly wrecked the door between the cells and the place, the steam, where they had this boiler, and went and wrecked the boiler and tore out of the pipes and things and other things. But anyhow, that occurred, and we found a tactic that, and one of the tactics I can is this time got organized on the people on the outside, our sympathizers got organized, and they would call into the police station, and they'd say, oh, there's 10 or 15 roughly dressed men coming in from out here, and well, then they would take sail out to that and find that these people have been seeing phantoms. And then about the time they got settled, a report would come into another part of the town that these phantoms would appear in another part of town, and still another, and another, and another, until they just wouldn't respond to those calls anymore. And then about the time they were worn out is when the influx of wobblies came in. Diversionary tactic. That was one of the things. That was my knock. That was my first big speech class.
Did you become a wobbly then?
No. Then I went down. I became a part of a member of the Socialist Party of North Dakota. And there I found such a terrible difference between the Socialist Party of Canada and the Socialist Party of America. It didn't seem like any that they were even remotely related to each other. I found most of them to be down here do-nothing spittoon philosophers. and that didn't suit me. So I never, after I left North Dakota, I never took out the post. When I went to repair to my father's house in Illinois, to stay that winter, I never joined the Socialist Party there. So we come up through 1914 and 1915 is when they started to intensify their drive to organize the agricultural worker, the IWW. And I wanted to join in that year, but I never caught I could never catch up with a job delegate who had supplies. They were lining them up so fast that they had never anticipated that rapid growth. And so they couldn't supply the delegates with cards and stamps enough to take care of this sudden influx of members. So all through 1915, I wasn't able to get a card. Nor in the early part of 1916. I have the same thing. Meantime, I've been in the harvest fields, went through the usual routine, starting in Kansas, going up through South Dakota, North Dakota, and perhaps wind up thrashing in Montana. In 1916, they opened an office at Omaha, Nebraska. And not finding any delegates with card, I headed for Omaha. And to my surprise, there was a man who had been in the Minot Free Speech fight that I'd got acquainted with at Minot, the Free Speech fight, Albert Preissner. I think I'm the first person who has ever made a delegate before he was a member. Only a moment before. Preissner said, "I know you," he says, "You're Jack Leonard." That's my first middle name. John L. John Leonard Leonard. And they had long since dropped the Miller part of it, and I was known off the horse field as Jack Leonard. And he said, "You're Jack Leonard. I knew you at Minot." And he said, "You come to sign up?" I said, "Yes." I said, and I laid my $2.50 down for the card and the first month's dues. He says, "Hey," and he didn't even look at that. He started over here writing on some papers here, and I thought, "What's up?" And he folded them all up and put an envelope to me, and he said, "Where's your supplies?" He says, "Now see how many you can line up." Well, I said, "Wait a minute." I said, "I've read the Constitution. I'm not eligible to be a delegate until I've been a member 3 months." "Well," he said, "I know you." He said, "That's all right." He said, "Oh," he said, "this is your 2.5. And he said, "All right." And he made up my card. That was July the 12th. 1916. I remember because my father's birthday comes on the 11th of July. On the 13th of July, I stayed overnight to rest up in Omaha before I continue my journey up to. I would go this season. I would go up through Missouri Valley, Sioux City, and up into South Dakota, going through Mitchell on the way. I'll skip one thing because I'm using too much tape now. But we met a bull of what we call a yard bull, a special agent, railroad special agent, and he learned to his surprise that he couldn't frighten 35 or 40 of us because he wore a gun, and we told him, we reminded him that there was a well-known receptacle for undesirable articles, and that his gun might occupy that space if he got nasty. And then we went to Sioux City. I stayed a few days in Sioux City again to rest up and prepare. Then I would say 200 or more of us got onto a freight train headed for the harvest field. But the first division point would be Mitchell, South Dakota. Somehow or another, they called a meeting and decided that I was to stay in Mitchell and organize the railroad workers. Now here I am, a member of Agricultural Workers, Local 400, and yet I was to stay and organize the railroad workers in Mitchell, South Dakota. Nobody's told me how I could do it. And I had nothing but agricultural workers' literature to distribute. But I knew that generally the first thing towards doing something like that was to call a street meeting, so I went down to the roundhouse there and told the people in the yard office and told them that I would be holding a street meeting. It was a Sunday morning, by the way. At 6 o'clock on Sunday night, I'd be holding a street meeting near the depot on the main street, Mitchell, North Dakota, Mitchell there. And came back, that didn't take very long, came back and we were sitting in front of the depot, and the station agent said, "Well, why, what are you guys sitting in this hot sun for? It's a nice shade tree about a block up the street here." So it's Ron's reason. Well, they left five men with me. And so they, now remember, nobody ordered me. They couldn't have said, "Now, Jack, here you do it." But they just said, "Jack, here's a job that needs to be done." And that was all that was required. And so we hadn't sat under that tree long until here come some well-dressed people. We were sitting right near the rail track of the lot that the street occupied was at a lesser elevation than the railroad. Now I'm trying to think whether the street, I know where it sloped down to cross the railroad there, that it was higher. But I believe that in general that lot was on the level with the rest of the town at the bottom of the lot. But anyhow, we were sitting on this bank caused by the hill, where the railroad hill was there. And these five, well, the dressed people came up. And we, of course, paid no attention, but they walked directly to us. First greeting out is, "Why didn't you men go out on that freight train?" And that was before finally says, "You go out on the next freight train." "Oh no, that came a little later." I said, "Now wait a minute, mister. I don't know who in the hell you are. But as where I come from, when we begin asking impertinent questions of a stranger, we usually take the trouble to introduce ourselves first."
"My father, he loves you very much."
"Now just who in the hell are you anyway?" Well, he explained he was the mayor, and the man by his side was the chief of police, and the city attorney was there. And who the fourth person was, I don't remember. There were four. He said, "Well, you guys get out of town on the next freight train." I says, "What? You, the mayor of the city, advising me to do an illegal act?" I said, "Don't you know that it's a gross misdemeanor in the state of North Dakota to ride freight trains? And you, the mayor of the city, are advising me to do that?" And then I said, "Just now, supposing we don't. Supposing we choose not to do that, what happens? You'll get 60 days in jail." I said, "Come on, fellow workers, we'll take her 60 days in jail." And we called her bluff, they let her to the city jail. Well, they had no more than turned the key on us until we greeted them with the old wobbly greetings. "You've locked us up, you sons of the witches. Now either feed us or shoot us." That was the first take. Not only that, we were all great singers. That is, we were in great voice, volume-wise. And a short distance away, shortly after we were locked up, a short distance away, the church services began. They didn't have a chance. We sang with the wobbly songs to their church tune. And that didn't sit well with the populace. They threatened to come in. They made all kinds of dire threats, and which fell on indifferent ears. And we were quite amused by the threats. And then Monday morning, we were taken before a justice of the peace. charged with vagrancy. So now you're charged with vagrancy, you're free, guilty or not guilty. Your Honor, I had learned this and when I was a volunteer organizer for United Mine Workers. One of the ways to take care of yourself as you ever got before, Jake. Your Honor, you were asking me to plead to a certain charge. And so far, I first asked our permission to get a spokesman. So far as I know, there is no such statute in the state of South Dakota, nor any such ordinance in the city of Minot, as far as I'm aware. If there any such statute or ordinance exists, I have never heard of it. And then, having never heard of it, how can I enter a plea as to guilt or innocence? Then the city attorney had to read both the whole statute of the state of South Dakota, the ordinance which covered it for the city of Minot. Then they said, now you heard, do you plead guilty or not guilty? Well, I said, just a moment. How can I? Your Honor, at the time of our arrest, we were only in Minot, a matter of a few hours. Now Your Honor knows, and the city attorney knows, that there would not have been time for us to violate every one of the sections of this ordinance and of this statute. Now how in the world are we expected to know which of these we are charged with? Certainly we're not pimps. Certainly we're not gamblers. You're not just... Which of these... in legal parlance, that would be called... We'd call for collection of charges. Then His Honor had to confer with him. Well, which one are you going to charge him with? Sorry, that one was trespassing on the railroad. And I said, "Is the council prepared to subpoena witnesses, complaining witnesses?" I said, "Well, maybe not, but we'll see about that later." And they said, well, now you heard the charge, you plead guilty or not guilty. I said, Your Honor, I know for certain that as defendants, we have a right, an absolute right, to one continuance. I said, I asked to be continued for 1 week. And he turned to me, on a bankruptcy charge, I said, you address the court. Don't talk to me. You address the court. He did. And if I were judged, I said, Your Honor, I said, I am laying the basis for a jury trial. If it comes to trial. Well, they went to conference and said, well, you're demanded to the custody of the chief of police of Minot for 1 week from today. I said, but one more thing, Your Honor. I said, I want instruction that I be allowed to telegraph to Sioux City for attorneys. Chief of Police will be as instructed that this man be allowed to communicate in such manner as he deemed necessary to legal counsel. E.J. Burke is secretary at Sioux City. This is the way I worded the telegram. E.J. Burke, Bo Worker, myself and five other fellow workers arrested and jailed in Mitchell, South Dakota, charged with vagrancy. Send attorneys, plural, send attorneys at once. They took us to the county jail, transferred us to the county jail, and that same afternoon we were playing, I think it was Cinch, Pedro, I think they call it out in this part of the country, down in the basement of the jail, and naturally in the basement of the courthouse. And word came down and sat down by one of the jailers that the sheriff wanted to see me, and I immediately sent word back that I wasn't anxious to see him. And that if he really wanted to see me, that it was just as easy for him to climb those stairs two ways as it was for me or for the rest of us. So take that message up to him, and he said there in my eyes, he said, you better do what I tell you. You go up and tell the sheriff that I don't intend to come up there and see him. If you want to see me, come down here and see me. Pretty soon he came back and he said, there's a whole room full of people waiting. They want to hear what's about the IWW. Oh, I said, that's different. I said, put on your hats and coats, fellow workers. We're going out. Well, remember, this was still, you can see there had not many days elapsed between my joining the IWW leads up to this time, perhaps 10, 15 days. I purposely omitted one other adventure in there because I, now, went up there and they said, we want you to tell us about the IWW, what they mean to do and what they know. I said, you want to know all about the IWW, and you expect me to tell you in one half day when we have books written about the subject, and you in a short brief period, you want me to tell you about the IWW. I said, I'll tell you what I'll do. And I was thinking what I was going to say next all this time, see. I said, I'll read the preamble to you, but I knew the preamble almost by heart. So I could be pretending to read the preamble and quoting it while I was thinking about what I was going to say next. When I'd come to the end of it, I don't say that it was verbatim by any means, but when I came to the end of it, I thought, no, I'm not going to make a speech. I'm going to lay it on the line. I said, I don't know what you people think, but what opinion you have of the IWW. I said, I do know you have a deadline here at the drinking fountain beyond which a migratory worker may not go in your city. So that pretty much expresses your attitude towards a migratory worker, doesn't it? Now, we were, the instructions at the convention was that we would not precipitate any free speech fights or any clashes with the town authorities, that we would to concentrate our efforts as an organization and on the job towards the farmer. Now, if the city of Mitchell is representative of the state of South Dakota, and you don't want any migratory workers in South Dakota, I said, I think it could be arranged that the IWW would just build a picket line all around South Dakota and discourage migratory workers from coming in here. I said, but where would your farmers get their harvest in? And do you want to answer to that to your constituency? I don't think it would be a very popular action on your part. If it's your request, we form this. Now, I said, that's what you want, isn't it? I said, in other words, you don't have any cards at all. I said, here you are. I said, you're trying to bluff me when you don't have any hand at all. I said, you can't bluff me. You can't bluff the IWW. And I said, if it's trouble you're looking for, we don't want any trouble. If it's trouble you're looking for, I advise you to telegraph to Minot, North Dakota, and see what happened to that county and that city when it precipitated trouble with the IWW. Both the county and the city wound up bankrupt when they got through paying the bills for that fiasco. So I said, you don't take my word for it. Don't call as much a telephone or telegraph up there. See if I'm telling you the truth. Now, if that's what you want, and that's what you're determined to have, that is what you will get. Yes, here I was, and here I was in captain. I don't think I hadn't had a bath. Well, I rode all night the freight train. The last bath I'd had was at Sioux City, and you can get awfully dirty riding in on a freight train in a very short time. Dirty face. I hadn't had a chance to shave. They took my razor, my safety razor, away from me when I was in the jail, and so I hadn't had a chance to shave, and there I was. Dirty faced, whiskers, and not a very prepossessing sight up there. But they listened. So they finally said, well, there's no reason why you boys should be tried or locked up. So we're going to let you go. And he said, how long will it take you to take your business, do to finish your business in Mitchell? I said, that's none of your business. We're free. We're free American citizens with all rights of citizenship. We don't have to account for it. Our intention is to how long we intend to stay. I said, you tend to your business and we'll tend to ours. And we walked out. I can't to this day understand why I did not immediately get to the telegraph office and let Burton know that we had been released. I still don't know. Not intentionally, but I just didn't think of it. So we spent the afternoon trying to find, not wanting to be vagging on something that makes stick. We went around and inquiring, trying to find a place where they would rent us a bed for the night. It was not forthcoming. Finally, I went to make it legal, I walked up a policeman on the street there, and I said, officer, I says, we've been to every hotel in this town, we've been to every boarding house that we can find, trying to get lodging for the night. No, I'm calling upon you to perform your duty as an officer and give us information as to where this lodging might be found. Well, they won't. He said, I don't care where you go. They're not going to rent a bed to you. They don't rent a bed to hobos in this town. And he said, nothing, don't blame me now. He said, I can't do anything about it. He said, they just won't do it. He said, they won't do it. Well, I said, what are we to do? Are we to apply to the city jail for lodging? Oh, no. I wouldn't do that. He said, you don't want to go to jail, do you? I said, no, I don't want to, but I won't find lodging. Well, he says, there's a boxcar right down there next to the depot, and he says, all lined with paper. They ship some furniture in there, and it's just as clean as it can be. And he says, you go down there and get in that boxcar. He said, I'm sure nobody will bother you. And right away, I thought, I had to grin. I looked at the other fellow workers, they were grinning. We're looking for a ship out, see? They'd get us in there, they'd slam the door, hook it to a train, and haul us out of town. But I said, all right. But before we went to this boxcar, we went down along the tracks and until finally found a rotten tire that we could kick a railroad spike out of it and try it by using rock. And then we could remove a railroad spike from one of the railroad ties. And then we went back and we shoved the door, left it open about that far in there, and then drove this spike between the door and the side of the boxcar. Wedged it, in other words. Well, when you drive that in there, you see the head of the spike bites into the wood. And that wedge is, there's enough pressure against that door that it'll take nothing less than a crowbar to move it. But it's very, you can very easily knock the spike out. Good. So there we stepped, put saying, say nobody bothered us. Fine. Next to the depot was a restaurant there, and it was called a Jungles Restaurant. It had been purposely named that to attract a migratory worker. Called a Jungles Restaurant. And we were all in there eating our breakfast the next morning when here a very much excited policeman come running in. He says, the mayor wants to see you outside. The mayor wants to see you outside. Well, you would tell the mayor I'm eating my breakfast. If his business can't wait till after we finish our breakfast here, why, he better come in and explain himself. We don't intend to bother ourselves about him. Well, the mayor and the chief of police are out there. I don't care who's out there. So he came in and he said, I want to talk to you. I said, all right, go ahead, talk. He went in and so he talked. In the meantime, we was eating our hotcakes, strip with bacon, and I was drinking the coffee, all the coffee we wanted. You got all the coffee you wanted, all for two bets. hotcakes and strip with bacon and butter and syrup and coffee. And so we wondered, when we had that kind of food and butter, we weren't going to be interrupted by any such an unimportant patron as the mayor. He can wait. And so we went outside, went in, finally got all through. I said, all right, I'm through now. We've got all work. Come on, follow work. He says, there's a freight train coming here and with 300 men aboard, and they're all heavily armed. I want you to go down there and stop them. I said, wait a minute. I said, say that again. Say it slowly. I don't think I understood what you said. He says, there's a whole freight train load, 300 of them, they say, all of them with heavily armed. I want you to stop them. What? You want me and these other 5-4 workers to go down to the railroad track and stop 300 heavily armed men from entering Mitchell? I said, is that what you're asking me to do? I said, how do you expect me to accomplish it? How do you expect me, or these other 4 or 5 workers, how do you, not just how do you think we're going to go about that? I said, what they're coming for? Well, they think you're still in jail up here.
I don't know.
I shook my head. I said, you know, you see what happens when constituted authorities begin to commit illegal actions. I said, I don't know. I don't know. What do you expect me to do? I said, don't you see? If you had acted in a legal manner, you had, first of all, no reason whatever to molest us, even by speaking to us. And then when you threatened, and then when you came and incarcerated us in your jail, don't you see how many illegal acts you committed, and what a terrible mistake it is? And now you come to me, and we 5 fellow workers, asking us to relieve you of the consequences of your illegal action. There's a more profanity in my explanation than in the presence. Well, I said, well, come on, fellow workers, we'll see what we can do. Well, I knew that my IWW card was not big enough for him to see as the train pulled in, so I took out the little red songbook and I waved it in one hand and held up 4 fingers to see if the Agricultural Workers Organization 400 And that was had become more or less an unofficial greeting. Four fingers up and waved the card. And some of them come flying, the train hadn't stopped. And some of them were piled off and come running towards me. And I said, we are the six fellow workers for the arrest of Sunday. We're the six fellow workers who are there. How the hell do we know who you are? You may be some finks. There's no doubt that some of those guys were armed. I don't know. So meantime, as we argued, we were walking back. They were facing us. We were walking back. We put us onto the main street, and soon this whole main street, just adjacent to that same to the depot and that same jungle restaurant, was filled with these angry IWWs. And I said, "Where's your train committee?" We always had a committee to examine cars to see, you know, who was on the train. Well, finally there. And they kept in there, and the yelling was going on. And finally, one policeman reached for his gun. Boy, I was sick. He reached for his gun. I told this, the mayor was standing beside me this time. And they tried, all three of them, the day police force were there. And the chief, and the... I said to the mayor, I said, "You tell that idiot to get that thing out of sight." "No, I want no bloodshed on the middle." I said, "The first thing to do is get hit. Get that out of sight." And I was, geez, I didn't know what to do. I had no idea. Here this was, these milling people here. All doubtful. All of them looking for it. Because they had pinched five fellow workers up there for no reason. No good reason. And they were angry about it. They knew that if that was allowed to continue, that they'd be in trouble all summer, and they were about to do something about it. Finally, came meeting. I said to the mayor, I said, "Get inside that restaurant and come back out here with a box or a stool, a chair, anything I can stand on that will raise me up a little bit above the level. My head would be a little bit above the level, and they'll recognize that as a soapbox." And I don't think he, someone anyway, I don't think it could have been, but somebody came and brought this out, and I immediately stepped on it. I was a fellow worker. We are supposed to be an organized body of men. But you're acting like a mob. Now let's get a meeting started here to see what's to be done. And the first order of business is the election of a chairman. This is whole routine. So somebody this time recognized me. "Well, Leonard, you're doing pretty good. Suppose you act as chairman." I said, "Well, let's have somebody nominated me, and who nominated you close that he'd be railroaded, that say he'd be railroaded, that was the elected by acclamation, see." And well, I said, "Well, now," I said, "we only have one thing to do.